Don, thank you very much for letting me come and talk to you. And this is the 31st of October, 2013, talking about the Oxford Medical School, really. And you've just been telling me, actually, about how you came here with the idea initially to read chemistry.
That's right, yes.
But then Christchurch were very acceptable.
They would? Well, yes. My chemistry teacher asked the whole group of us who'd attended him for the very first time, and he said, everyone happy with their course? And I said, I'd like to read medicine instead, please. And he said, of course, boy, we'll see that through. Yes, and he did. Yes.
So how long did you take on the prelims, the zoology and botany?
I think they ran parallel with some of the first medical ones, and I did that for two terms. And so I extended my time in Oxford from 3 years and a term up to 4 years, which was nice.
Yes. Absolutely. Another summer term. And what do you really remember of the first 2 years when you were doing anatomy and physiology mainly?
One of my great inspirations came in those years, because Dan Cunningham and Brian Lloyd were in the physiology department then. Of course, they were interested in things respiratory, and I liked both of them, and they taught well, and I'm sure that is one of the factors that eventually pushed me into respiratory medicine.
Douglas would have retired by then, is that right? Priestley and Douglas, you know that.
Yes, yes, they'd gone, but yes. I've still got their book upstairs, yes.
But how about Meadows, the laboratory assistant? Was he there?
Now I do remember.
Yes, I thought you might.
Yes, yes, that's right. And of course, one of the most striking episodes in the laboratories was not there, but it was when we were doing the Dunn School, and when the microbiologist
Vollum,
he was there, and during our time, some misguided young man who was on the course tipped down the drain. I think it was some salmonella. And he was literally kicked out of the school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So did he, did he qualify, as it were? Or if he was kicked out, what happened?
No, none of us knew. Yes. I mean, I don't remember.
No, sure.
What happened to him, no. No, I mean, certainly he wasn't allowed to go into the microbiology. And later on in my life, as a junior doctor, I met him socially. He was still as gruff as he ever was, and because his daughter Dorothy and I were both house officers at the old Osler Pavilion.
Yes.
She was doing the neurology part with the patients who'd got
tuberculosis meningitis.
Yeah, yes. It's all tuberculosis. Mm. Because when she was off, I had to do these. And that was the phase where they were injecting into the spinal cord tuberculin.
Yes, yes.
In minute quantities, but Dorothy did it and I did it. And it seemed to produce some results, but of course, how can you say from the way we were running things in those days?
So Honor Smith was there.
Honor Smith was, yes, sorry.
What are your memories of her?
I thought she was a lovely eccentric and a very good neurologist.
Yes.
My most lasting memory is quite some time later when I first became a consultant and I did general medicine down at the old Radcliffe and respiratory medicine up at the Churchill. But started on the 1st of January 1971, I suppose it would be, maybe 70. And We had two cases of meningitis. And one was tuberculous, and she took him off fairly quickly. The other one was not, and I sought her advice. This guy had got an inner ear infection which had spread inwards, and he was pretty sick, and we'd got what's the organism? Pneumococcal.
Yeah.
Of course it was, pneumococcal. And I can see her now. She came in from one of her outside pursuits, leant over the edge of the bed, looked at the patient, probed him about a bit. And he said, I'd been giving her, on the advice of the then professor of medicine, no less than Beeson.
Right.
We've been doing, 20 whatever units they were a day into a vein. And she said, no, this man needs intrathecal. Yeah. And that was quite against Prof. Beeson's edicts on that. And he was, after all, an infectious disease. Yeah. And she said, he needs burr holes. Because we couldn't get back into the spinal cord down there in the bay. Yes. So she whisked him off into the next bit, and they drilled holes. And of course, it was pure pneumococcal gunge they got out. And he had the penicillin put into his thecal cavity.
Yeah.
And he was the first one to survive out of 10.
Very good.
Yeah. And I was very impressed.
Yes.
And she was such a... She was such a unique character.
Yes.
She was, she was so very good, so very kind.
Yes.
I thought she understood patients very well.
Yes.
That's because she had a very broad base in her intellectual interest, didn't she?
Yes, indeed. But just to go back, who was your tutor for the first 2 years in Christchurch?
Heaton.
Oh, gosh.
Yes. He was just retiring.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. That was a surprise, and meeting a man of that calibre and interest and different social background to the little boy from a grammar school in South London. But he taught me quite a lot.
Yeah.
There was also, right at the end, there was a temporary one too who I didn't see much of. But it was mostly Heaton. And I remember going out to his house in St Giles for a tutorial or two. Do you know where that is? Yeah, it's just about where St Giles breaks into the two roads.
Right.
And
yeah.
It's on the west side. And it's set back from the road. It's still there. I suppose it's still owned by Christchurch.
And did he tutor you for schools too? For the third year, for the anatomy and for the...
No, he'd have gone by then.
Right. Your fourth year, probably.
Yes. I don't remember. I can't remember the name of this other guy who was at Christchurch then.
Livingston? No.
No.
And then, where did you go for your clinical training?
Well, I got some sort of exhibition to Barts.
Right.
Yes. I went to my interviews at St Thomas's and Barts. St Thomas's clearly wanted me to be able to play rugby, and I couldn't. Well, I'd stopped.
Because,
I mean, I did in my first year, but I was never a great rugby player. I played in the school first 15, but not good enough for St Thomas's. So I went to Barts.
Did you enjoy that?
I did. We certainly saw a lot of different people, because as you moved around the hospital, you saw plenty of people, and there are lots of interesting memories. of the bombastic ones. And I have to say that I wasn't greatly enamoured with the professor.
Scowen?
Gowen, yeah, mm-hmm. Scowen. Mm-hmm. That's right. Except for one amazing factor, one of our group was a diabetic, and he came in to the hospital, he was admitted to the hospital in diabetic coma, and I think that was the result of, he got pleurisy and he got an effusion, mm-hmm. and Scowen treated him himself. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That actually altered my view of him.
Yes.
Because he'd been... I had felt that he was rather rough on his junior colleagues. I mean the consultants that were in his team.
Right.
He looked down on them and he made it evident that he didn't think they were as good as he was.
Dickie Watts, was he there?
Yes. Yes, he was. didn't see a lot of him.
Right, so he wasn't in the Scowen team.
He was on the edge of it.
Right.
Yes, but he had more strength than some of. It was the ones that arrived during my time that it struck me that he was not going to have any upstart and pushing him on one side.
And was there a youngish chap called John Crawhall there? Crawhall. No reason why you
should. No.
Sure. And then you did house jobs there, did you, probably?
No. Well, the story behind that is that in my last year, I got married.
Right.
And despite the fact I think I came second in the last, in final exams, you know, and they said... if you're married, you either do my house job, or you stay married. You know,
God.
That was how it was in those days.
I know, but terrible, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean these days.
I mean that's
they'd
what,
be in the law courts.
That's I mean we're late 50s probably.
Yeah.
So where did you get it on?
Well, I went to one of the places that we went to for our outside experience, and that was at Red Hill.
Yes.
I enjoyed Red Hill immensely. In fact, I did three jobs there. Started with surgery, then medicine, and then I did a emergency admissions one, you know, seeing anything.
A&E, casualty,
yes, that sort of thing, yes.
And did you know you wanted to be a physician by then?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. So, I mean, doing surgery first was another sign of the outer darkness.
No, again, that was a very good experience because the chap in Norman Pitt was the consultant, and he was a good surgeon, and he let us do things. Particularly, I remember. Well, perhaps not so much with him personally, but certainly with his senior... there wasn't a senior, there was just a registrar. Me, a registrar, and him. That's right. Mm-hmm. The registrar, whose name escapes me, he was very good to us students. Well, first-year people. And he allowed us quite a lot of leeway. Mm-hmm. And in that 6 months, I did a dozen appendectomies and a dozen, whatever we would know.
Tonsillectomies?
I suppose they were tonsillectomies, yes. Yeah. And it was a very good experience.
Yes. So what about anaesthetics? Were you doing that too or not?
No, I don't think I ever did any actual anaesthetics.
But as a student, what was your memory of that? Because mine is absolutely primitive at the Middlesex.
Yeah, I... No, I can't separate it from other anaesthetic experiences much later in life. No, I can't.
So where were you a registrar? Registrar.
Well, I did 18 months there, Then I came up here.
Oh, right, okay.
And did a, what do they call it? A post-registration house job.
Right.
And that was at the Osler.
Right.
Yeah, at the Osler Pavilion. And that's where Dorothy Vollum was working.
And was Ona still there?
Yes, she was still there. Okay. Then, yeah. And, you know, we were there in a field of sheep with a couple of buildings.
Yes.
And the manor house was where the nurses lived. I enjoyed that because we got plenty of experience, and there was a lot of TB still around. And it was a stage where people were still doing, getting the chemotherapy right.
Yes.
And doing lots of trials.
And were you doing the bromide ratio?
No, I don't remember.
No. And you weren't having the multiple sclerosis patients, because, you know, Ona was playing with tuberculin.
There was just tuberculosis up there.
How long had you intended to come back to Oxford? I mean, was it a late decision, or had you always thought you'd come back to Oxford to work?
I thought I would rather go to Oxford than go back to London. Mm-hmm. I felt I'd been sorely treated there. And they wouldn't have me. But I did want to go back to Oxford. Mm. And that lasted just for that one job. And so I asked about other things there. Mm. And I guess my next job came when somebody said, why don't you go out to Manchester? There's a lot of good things going on there. And so basically I went up there and did a senior house officer job there with a chap called Brockbank. Mm-hmm. He was one of the traditional old medical bachelors who lived for the medical school and for his hospital. And he was a tremendous man, lovely, a big man as well, in every way. Mm-hmm. Very generous, very kind. You know, one of his first things to me was when we arrived in Oxford, he said, now, I want to know that you've got somewhere to live and you're happy with that. Can't have a chap who's wondering about where he's going to live.
Yeah.
And we had, we brought our first house there, south of Manchester. So I enjoyed that, and because he was good, and Douglas Black was the professor then, and he was good. I can always remember, several things one sees in one's mind, doesn't it? One of them was the... the milk drip for all these people with various forms of indigestion. And, whether they had ulcers or not, I don't suppose most of them know, but this was poured in. I can see those things hanging around the board. And then I can also remember, Douglas Mack was, he was a wonderful man because he has... a brilliant mind. He spoke the most perfect English, Scottish English. Yes. And the way in which he formulated his sentences, both in speech and in writing, was impeccable. There was a little club where people, which we all met, and he would be the chairman there. And, you know, he always had something wonderful to say, if you could hear it, because he had this very quiet voice. And a lot of his jokes were asides, and you had to be really on. And they were always some of them dry humour, but he was very good. I can remember him saying he said the only people who really need to be in bed for an illness, well, he wanted it for people with renal failure.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly when there was that, and I guess heart failure, he allowed them. But he thought most people shouldn't be lying in bed all the time.
Yes, he's right.
Well, he was absolutely right. It was a bit before his time.
Absolutely.
Then.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, how much of the family would you see doing that job?
Of
the family, would you see the family?
You mean?
I mean, your wife.
My own family. Yes. Oh, no. Well, for that year, it wasn't that bad.
No.
All right, I had to go into Manchester. We lived about 10 miles away, I suppose. But I could go in a bus. But then I had 2 years there doing research for Jack Howe.
Right.
And whilst I did have some clinical duties, they were daytime clinical duties, doing clinics.
Yes.
But so I did 2 years then with him.
So you were researching then?
Yeah, that was when I did my research, yeah.
And that was a doctorate, was it?
Yeah.
Yes. What was that on?
It was a time when there were two things going on in our area. People were interested in what they called blue bloaters and pink poppers.
Yeah, they were.
Remember that?
I do.
That's largely gone out of the sights of people these days, and I think it is because the blue bloaters never get to that stage these days because they're treated much earlier and we've got better medicine. I mean, I can remember the time when aminophylline came in, you had to inject it into a vein.
Yes, I can indeed.
Yeah,
yes.
You know, we really didn't have the kit.
Yes.
And we were interested, Jack was interested in whether this was something to do with the control, cerebral control. We did various studies of that, and we certainly found that the people who were blue bloaters, their CO2 was rising very quickly through as they got more sick, whereas the pink puffers, it stayed relatively flat and then shot up at the end. And so we thought that was something to do with central control. And we did quite a lot of lumbar punctures on these poor chaps with chronic obstructive lung disease. And I don't remember it going through any ethics committee or anything like that. Just a little prick in your back. You know.
And what was that
but
to
certainly
do?
The...
do you measure the CO2 or...?
Yeah, that's right, yes. And we certainly saw it going up, and the brain seemed to have no control over it. Whereas in most of the other disturbances of acid base, the body managed to get things right, but it couldn't do it up here in the brain. Here. And these people, of course, went into respiratory failure. So that was one aspect of it. We did quite a lot of work on that. And that came into it. And also we were interested in the nature of breathlessness. It was about the time when Jack Howell and Maura Campbell brought out their book on breathlessness. And it's a very difficult area. And I don't think we got very far. The one thing we did manage to show that we were measuring let me get this right, yes. We felt that the real problem with the breathlessness was that the lungs were expanding, and instead of you being able to breathe out to the natural equilibrium point, they couldn't do it. And so all the time they were breathing at the top of their respiratory excursions.
Right.
And I can remember, I remember Maura Campbell saying this. It was the time when we met him, and he would say to the students, take a big breath in and now try and breathe in and out. You could see.
Yes.
He was absolutely right.
Yeah.
And we measured that, and we could show that that was the case. And that continued a bit after when I came here eventually. Yeah.
So after Jack Howells, you came back to Oxford, did you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Into a consultant post?
No. That was an interesting one. I applied for Beeson's registrar job. Mm-hmm. I suppose it was just a registrar then, although it became a senior registrar. All right. Yeah. And I heard nothing. And somebody Oh, Ralph Wright was still here in Oxford, and somebody in Oxford knew him, in Manchester knew him.
Well, Jack might have known him. Both went to Southampton in the end.
Yeah, Jack didn't. Yes, no, I know, but that would be later.
Yeah, no, sure.
Yeah, okay. No, I can see the guy. I can't remember his name, but he said to Ralph, "Who got that job?" And Ralph said, "Oh, well, he hadn't appointed anyone. He didn't like any of the applicants." So this chap, he gave me a little boost, and I had to telephone call, would I come down and see Professor Beeton? I went down, I was the only person there, went into his office, we chatted for about half an hour. Would you like my job?
Yes, lovely. Those were the days.
I mean, those were the days.
Yes.
And so I did a couple of years as it was the only job I did as a registrar. And then they, when that was up, they made me into a lecturer, and I was jointly between medicine and anaesthetics, so I didn't do any anaesthetics. Yeah. I was doing lung function there. Mm. Well, then when it came to the end of that, the job came up at the Churchill for the chest department, and again they gave me a joint job with medicine and that.
Yes. So what are your memories?
Riddy House was the guy who retired.
Right.
Yeah.
What are your memories of Beeson?
A frustrated man.
Oh, gosh.
He was used to being in command, and when he said something could be done, should be done, it was done. In Oxford, he needed to go through the rigmarole of all the university authorities,
right,
when he wanted to change something.
Yeah.
And he was frustrated.
Right. But in a more immediate sense, on the wards.
Oh, yeah.
A happy man on the wards.
I'm afraid I think it reflected on everything he did. I found him a sad man in many ways.
Okay.
Yeah.
And who was holding his hand? Jim Holt was his registrar.
Yeah, and who was the... the guy who went into the... names go, don't they? The politics side of medicine.
Atchison.
Atchison.
Right.
Yeah. He was the right hand man there.
Right.
Yeah.
What do you remember of him? Because he was a quiet guy.
Yeah, but he was also very rigid.
Was he?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, all right, I'll give you an anecdote from those times. We had those meetings where the cases that were around the ward were discussed, so that everybody who had a say. I can remember Jim Holt describing a patient, he said he came from some Irish bog or other, and Atchison lifted his head up and said, "Which bog?" And Jim said, "Well, wherever it was. I used to live there."
Well done.
Yes.
No, I don't call that rigid, but anyhow, there you are.
No,
I know.
But he stood up for... all right, that one wasn't rigid, no, but I thought he was...
Then there was a lot of haematology going on.
Yeah,
Sheila Cannon.
Yeah, Sheila, there, yeah. And got on very well with Sheila.
Good.
Yeah. So I thought she was a very good lady.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Beeson was doing infectious disease, was he?
Yes, I don't know how much he was actually doing infectious disease. I think he's much broader than that. Though he was called in when there were infectious disease problems, of course, and I remember calling him myself, yeah.
So from Beeson's place, did you see anything of Pickering?
Not a lot. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, he was there, and there were often... Well, you saw him about the place, and you sometimes went to meetings or seminars and things that he was doing. No, I didn't see much. I think I remember most of him about him cycling to Oxford, where particularly when he got one leg that wasn't operating and still was doing it.
Yes.
Yes. What did he do? Did he fracture it or did he...
He had, osteoarthritis and he had a hip replaced at one time, but whatever.
Yeah.
I forget which. Okay, so then you got your job at the chest at the Churchill Plus, General Medicine Directive. How easy was it to combine those?
It was okay. I cycled everywhere in those days, so I got quite fit because whilst it was easy enough going down to the old Radcliffe Infirmary, it was a little bit tough coming back up to the Churchill, but that was all right. We lived in the Old Road.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I found it reasonable. And again, I'd got two very experienced seniors in Bill Hamilton and John Black. And the other person who was around then was Bob Marshall.
Yes, I remember.
Very quiet, withdrawn man almost. He, painfully shy in company, but absolutely brilliant in one-to-one conversation. And he was doing lung function, you see, in the Department of Surgery before Peter Morris's time.
Yes, with Alison.
With Alison, yes. Well, I suppose he must have been appointed by Alison to do that job, yes. Yeah.
And when you worked with the anaesthetic people, was that at the Radcliffe or up at the Churchill?
We didn't. I didn't really work with them, even though I had a name. I think it was just where they got the money from.
Yeah, no, I understand. Yeah.
I mean, I did lung function there, and I did, and yes, and I did a little bit of research into various things there whilst I was there.
Because Crampton Smith would have been going strong.
Yeah. Yes. Did you? Yes, I think he'd already started when I got that job. Yes, he did, yes.
And
I liked him enormously. Yeah. He was very, very good.
And John Spaulding was around.
Yeah, John was great too, yes.
Right. Yeah. Because it's been interesting talking to people. Some think John should have been made the Professor of Neurology. And then a bit later, I think he and Crampton Smith simultaneously applied for the Chair of Anaesthetics.
Oh, right.
Which of them should have got it?
Oh, I think Alex.
Yeah,
because he was a niece to this.
Yes, absolutely. And
I came in touch with them. That it was a time when there were still patients around who'd had polio and had respiratory problems, and it was with particularly with Alex. We invented this extraordinary machine because we realized that, and this all tied in with my acid base stuff, because these people basically had respiratory failure due to not being able to breathe. what we found was, it was really quite extraordinary, that if we could, rather than putting them into an iron lung, because they weren't bad enough for that, if he could give them some device whereby every so often in the day, I think we three or four times, Alex's team in the department produced an inverted vacuum cleaner, in fact, a handheld vacuum cleaner thing, so that the air that came out went into a pipe, and they put the pipe in their mouth, and it blew their lungs up.
Yes.
I mean, it was crude, but in fact, we found a significant, not clinical and objective, improvement by doing this, and they didn't have to do it all the time. That was the interesting thing. Their CO2 came down, their oxygen went up.
Great.
Which is... And there was, I remember some of those patients, they were absolutely wonderful people.
Yes.
They would go round the world in a van with all their kit in the back and things like that. They were, I think, people with that sort of disability, and I saw it later in life with the cystic fibrosis lot. they've all got guts, and by Jove, did it. I mean, that's half the battle in, not everything, isn't it? But it certainly is with health, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you fight it, the doctors can sometimes help you on along the way.
So there were huge changes in the chest unit in your time.
Yes.
And just talk about those, because what you did change, didn't it? The sort of patient mix, I think.
Yeah, you see, it started with virtually... Well, even before I got my job at the OSDA, they also had the second bit, Sunnyside, that was called, which was the... I think anybody of the old Rattler could use that for recuperation for people who couldn't quite get home, that sort of thing. But it was eventually taken over for the other forms of chest disease. And the tuberculosis died down and all the rest built up. And, of course, we were on the site where the John Ratcliffe was going to be put up, so that in 1978-9, we were ousted out of there and went to put beds in the Churchill, beds in the Slade. It was a bit a piecemeal. Yes. And at that time, the main respiratory unit settled on the Churchill, and we had two wards there.
So that was when chest started at the Churchill?
No.
Sunnyside moved. It was extra, was it?
When that was knocked down to build the JAR one, we were scattered.
Yeah, but before that there had been chests.
Oh yes, there had. Same time as the TB one, right back to the time when I was a house officer there. Yeah, and of course, Bill Hamilton and John Black retired at about that same time. So after I'd been in post for about about 10 years,
right,
and that was when Malcolm Benson came,
right,
and Malcolm and I, we also had Bob Marshall, but we didn't get another new consultant for some time after that. So we had more patients, but. Because a lot of the patients with respiratory disease came straight to us instead of going to the emergency hospital.
Yes.
Or if they went to the emergency hospital, they came to us quite quickly. And then the other change that then has occurred is that by the time the JR2 was built, more patients went up there. And we then got John Stradling in post, and he was developing all the sleep apnea stuff. And so there was a great shift in that direction.
Right.
Yeah.
But asthma seemed to, from an outsider, seemed to become more important.
Yes, well, the asthma story is... The story there is that in 19... Well, it must have been about 74-5... I was asked by OUP to write a book on asthma for the lay public. You know, they did the series Name of Disease Follow the Words of the Facts.
Yes, I remember.
Yeah. I had, of course, been working on asthma with Jack Howe right back that far, because it was he who worked with Roger Altunian to produce Intal.
Right.
Sodium chloroglycate, which was the first drug that ever attempted to be a protective rather than a treatment of emergency asthma. And it was a good drug, but it wasn't very powerful. So that was got me interested in that side of things. So I'd written this book, and then in 1978, Murray Turner Warwick got in touch with you and said, would I come on to the Asthma Research Council to look into the question of whether there is a need for an asthma society or something like that mm-hmm. for patients. So I did, and the short answer to that is we decided yes, it was needed. Yeah. And so I was the... There was a lady who had run what they called the Friends of the Asthma Research Council. That was a pure fundraiser. But of course, you can't have fundraisers going to meetings without asking questions, so it was natural this should happen. And the other thing, of course, is that during that time, inhalers had come in.
Mm-hmm.
And the best story about that is one that told by Charles Fletcher.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I could see we were in the middle of a sort of melee of people, and he said, I realised last week that this organisation was very much needed. I said to my patient, show me how you use your inhaler. And she did it like that, and then went... In other words, she was using her armpit as the place that she thought she should put this spray. So, yes, we thought we were probably needed.
Marvellous, yeah.
Yes. And then I got really embroiled with that because I spent a lot of my time talking about asthma. And we went through the first up to... So that was 1998 that we started this thing that was called the Asthma Society and Friends of the Asthma Research Council, because the very forceful lady who'd set up that wasn't going to let it go her too. Yeah. And she was the first chairperson and I was the vice chairman. Yeah. And then she dropped out and I took over. And in 1990, yes, one of the problems was that the money that had been given to the Asthma Research Council was ring-fenced for that and couldn't be used for the patient help in any way. Mm-hmm. So we had to raise our money in other ways. But at the end of the 1980s, we managed to get round this by some legal thing or other, and I was chairman of that organisation, and I still keep in touch with somebody who was the chief executive then. She lives in Herefordshire now with husband and several dogs, and I because I go to that part of the world for music festivals,
right.
I see her there. We nearly always meet up. So yes, the asthma took over a lot of my time towards the end of my career.
And the beta blocker inhalers, were they a great advance?
No.
Right.
Do I mean that? I think that, undoubtedly, they were a great advance. But it was still, what we were all looking for was that there's something that could be taken regularly and prevent attacks.
Yes.
Because however clever the relief is by using your Ventolin or whatever, sometimes what is not infrequently too late. And one saw the bad end of the spectrum. I know there's a lot of mild asthma that is clearly easily controlled by that. So it was the steroid inhalers when they came in that gave us much more likelihood of prevention.
Right.
And that line from sodium chloroglycate, people were researching that, and indeed I was involved in what was that one called? Anyway, there was another drug that they thought would be a preventive and wasn't a steroid, but that didn't really last very long. So and there still isn't anything. There's been no real advance in the preventive treatment of asthma since the steroid inhalant.
And Malcolm Benson was doing more respiratory failure, was he? Sort of chronic bronchitis, emphysema.
I think we were all doing that.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, we were all very cosmopolitan, actually. We did, there was Malcolm and I, we did whatever came through the door. And it's still, in those days, we're still doing a lot of lung cancer.
Yes, of course.
And including the treatment of it. That was been taken away.
Yes. So when did you stop general medicine doing...
Oh, wait, that was at the time when the JR2 opened. So that will be 80.
Right, okay. And what made you stop?
Oh, because when Malcolm came, they insisted that he did general medicine, and there was no place for me.
God, were you annoyed at that or not?
No.
No.
I mean, I think it's incredibly important that people who are doing a rather specialist area, even though respiratory medicine is quite a big area, it's still specialised in relation to general medicine. If you've done the general medicine, you don't make silly mistakes. Mm-hmm. And I think all people doing specialist things should do a spell. Whether it's adequately catered for now when they do they do 3 months a year or something like that, I don't know. Yeah. But certainly that continuous spell of nearly, I think it was 9 years for me. I never regretted that. Mm-hmm. I always remember too, Bill Hamilton, although he never did general medicine, he worked in the army, so he'd seen all sorts of funny things, but he was very aware of all the non-respiratory mm-hmm. things that could cause breathlessness. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, it's enormous. You've got anemia.
Yes.
You've got neuromuscular disease. Yeah. You know, you've got heart disease. Yeah. You know, it is very important that you think of those things.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then Julian Hopkin joined the team.
Yeah, Julian and John Trandling. I think it was John first and then Julian. No, it was the other way around, Julian and then John. That was when at last we were given money to get another consultant. Because I think the spell when Malcolm and I were doing it alone, it was pretty hard then. We always had good senior chance.
Yes.
And barring two, I can think.
Once you were a consultant, were you always NHS or was there any university input?
No, I stayed up until the time when I became just Chess Benson.
Right.
I held two university sessions.
Yes, A and B.
Yeah.
And then you became entirely NHS. Yeah. Yes.
And the only private patients I saw were those who, usually university people who'd got some sort of insurance and they wanted to come, you know, and say who they would come and see. And I didn't mind that.
And you'd have been working with the whole... Now, was Julian the one who brought genetics in?
Yeah.
And was that... did that help?
It helped the reputation of the department, and it brought a very lively and delightful man into the department. And a man who was quite... He had more clever ideas and understanding and indeed success in proving his ideas than most people I know.
Yes.
More than his fair share. Yeah, he was a very inventive mind.
Yes. But the actual genetic knowledge has probably not changed things. No. Or has it? No. Then cystic
fibrosis. I mean, when he went to Swansea, he was still working on that. I mean, he was interested in it was certainly asked, but it was also the whole of allergy.
Mm-hmm.
And he was quite convinced, and I think he had some good evidence, and I don't know what's happened to it since, that in the chain from the allergen hitting the part of the damage, the body and the cell, there was a whole train before you got the allergic reaction. Mm-hmm. And in the middle, somewhere there, he was convinced there was a very small molecule that could be dealt with.
Right.
He was still enthusiastic about the last time. I haven't seen him for 2 or 3 years.
And Bill Cookson, was he around?
Bill, I haven't seen Bill for ages.
No, he's down in London, I think.
Yes, that's right, yes.
Now, sort of on the national scene, you obviously had the Asthma Society.
Yeah.
And the research, any other commitments? MRC or, you know...
I didn't mind. Well,
college?
I was... committees of the Thoracic Society,
right, yes.
And one always gets 1 year's term as a president.
Great.
When you're a sort of figurehead more than anything.
When did you do that?
In 92-3, right. I think it was, yeah.
And what, any memories of that?
Yes, only sort of jokey ones, yes. I mean, the London meeting... That it was still at the time when we held a big dinner, and ours was on that occasion. It was held at Madame Tussauds.
Right.
And I think I did a jokey speech about my about imagining my various colleagues in there, you know, what they looked like.
Yes. Now, looking back, do you think your Oxford education helped you in your medical career?
Well, I wouldn't have had a medical career without it.
Yeah, sure.
I certainly, as I said before, I certainly think that the physiology, the respiratory physiology I learned, stayed with me and was very valuable.
Yes.
The rest, it all impinged in some way or other. I don't think there's any way in which it couldn't. Mm. I do feel that the way in which Oxford teaches you does give you the ability to think outside the box.
Mm-hmm.
And that is terribly important.
Yes, yeah.
And it's very important in medicine.
Yes. Then, of course, cystic fibrosis, your brother died of it.
Yeah.
But you saw the changes in that, or were they in paediatrics, really?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was an incredible change when we got heart-lung transplant. But, of course, one has to say that the genetic people haven't helped. Well, they've tried very hard,
yeah,
but they haven't got the answer. And the success that gradually occurred was just by good medical care with the tools we had available and the increasing complexity of the organisms and therefore the increasing search for antibiotics and antimicrobials that would deal with those. And that certainly happened, and I saw that change, and I saw, you see, when my brother died, that was an interesting, again, little anecdote. You see, he was 15 at a time when he was born. The disease didn't exist. It was one of the wasting diseases of childhood.
Right.
And about 1940, 41, it was split off from celiac disease. They thought they were now different.
Yeah.
Just a bit of clinical observation,
yeah, yeah,
that really.
Yeah.
but at that time, the average survival was 2 years, you see. And of course, by the time I came to the end of my career, it was very obvious, because we were finding so many different genetic differences,
different types
of, yeah. And clearly, he was at a very you say mild end of it. You know, Eli went down when he was 15, yes. And that was mild in those days. Well, I remember meeting at it was a historical conference a load of us were at about, I think it was about asthma, really. Mm. But Archie Norman was there, who was the paediatrician at Thomas's, mm. and looked after my brother. And I spoke to him and I said who I was. And I said, I don't suppose you remember my brother. And he said, of course I do. And then, of course, he dawned on me. Of course he did. Nobody else lived to 15.
No, right.
Yes. He was a lucky man too, yeah. Mm. So, but what of course we saw was the improvement in clinical care, not done by the doctors, but by all those wonderful people who did all the sort of the physiotherapists and the nurses and all that. And then we got heart lung transplant.
Yes. So you linked up with.
So what I did.
Fairfield.
Yeah, I. In that sense, yes. No, but what I saw was that the paediatricians in Oxford, Brian Bauer, was able. I used to go to his clinics, so I would take over the patients when they reached the age that they should be in an adult clinic.
Right.
And that's continued, of course, since. Yes. And of course, now the survival is, if you're born today with it, you know, it is 40 plus.
It's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And that's still just good clinical care.
Well, is the development of antibiotics, you think?
Oh, and with the, yes, yeah, you yeah. have to have the antibiotics. Yeah, but yeah. that's clinical care. It's dealing with the disease.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, after the cephalosporins, what have been the big advances in antibiotics to you?
You're asking me to remember the name.
No,
now,
don't worry.
I think it was dealing with the Pseudomonas, really.
Right, yes. Yeah.
I don't know where they got to with that at the moment.
No, I don't either. Yeah.
But I think that was the devil.
Yes. And Harefield, I mean, did you find it easy to get patients in there?
It was, if you made a good case, yes, you could get patients in, yes. We did quite a lot of them in the end. We were down to Papworth.
Right, okay.
But that was the sort of old university connection, wasn't it?
Terence English, I'm
trying to think back. I think Papworth probably took more of ours than.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Because. Maureen Thompson, you know, the paediatrician, yeah. she works with Harefield, it seems to me. I mean, when yeah. you hear her talk about things.
Yeah. Well, yeah. There may be some connection that she'd also had in some other direction,
yes.
yeah.
Sure. Was Papworth yeah. Terence English? Or
yes.
He was Hart, very yeah. much, but he's probably.
No, he would.
Yes, great. Yeah. Now, Don, anything I should have asked you about that you want to say?
No, I don't think so. I tell you one thing I would say that's got nothing to do with medicine but a lot to do with the hospital.
Right.
That is one of the legacies that I should be most pleased to leave behind, if it's still there when I'm still, is the hospital orchestra.
Right, yes.
Because we started that in the first concert given by medical staff for raising money was in 1978, and that was a nurse died of melanoma, mm-hmm. and her parents worked in the hospital, and there was a visiting Australian singer. And he and one of the surgeons who was on, they were on the same ward, were asked by the parents, mm-hmm. could they do a concert in honour, well, in memory of Jill Broadus, who had died. And I was part of that. Then the next year, the Australian who organised it the first year, he'd gone back to Australia, of course. So the parents said to me, would I do it? So we did another one.
Great.
And then it built up, and we finished up. And we always have done concerts for medical charities. Mm-hmm. That's the way to get bums on the seats.
Yes. See?
Because they get all the money. Since we do it in the hospital, there's no fee for the venue. Mm. And in fact, we're doing one Saturday week.
Right. You do one a year or seven?
Three a year.
Right.
Three a year now. And the 100th should fall in March 2016.
Great, great. That'd be terrific to see that, wouldn't it?
I mean, I think that. I think I might be remembered more for that.
Rubbish. But I know what you mean.
Yeah,
I'm sure.
I am very pleased that that happened. And
thinking way back, now you'd been in Bath, so know the medicos, you know, the marriage business, but you must have had an idea of the standard of care at Bath's. And when you came to Oxford, how would you say it compared with Bath's, or with Redhill, for that matter?
If you are talking about the current scene where the health service is being lambasted for standards of care, I don't think that at that stage I was able to draw any conclusions by comparing Oxford, Barts and Redhill.
But you must have felt this is a good ship or this is a dump. I mean, what was your feeling when you came to Oxford, to the Ears of Pavilion?
I think I thought that the Radcliffe and Fairbury was better, yeah, it was better than Barts. Mm-hmm. Barts was incredibly specialised, and I'm sure they did great things for people with specialised illnesses. But, and all right, it was also the first aid post for Smithfield Market. But as students, we didn't see a lot of that.
Yeah.
We saw a lot of the specialist stuff. And as far as our training was concerned, I certainly learned more about being a doctor and the techniques that you needed to be a house officer when I got my house officer job, rather than in preparation for it.
Yes.
Because I had never done a lumbar puncture until the registrar in the surgical ward at Redhill taught me how to do it. And he had been trained, he'd done a lot of work in Africa where he did a lot of it, and I learned how to do it with the patient sitting up.
Right,
because he would have a row of them out there. One, two, three.
Right, right. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. So I think Barts did not give me a good technical training.
Had it ever occurred to you to do your clinical in Oxford? Back then, I know.
Well, no.
Not many people did.
No, people said to us, you don't want to do it in
Oxford. That's right. Yeah.
By the time I came here as the consultant, well, at the end of the year before, I thought it was pretty good. Yeah.
Yes. And so it was, did you ever go to the Witchery for case presentations, or was it always Beeson?
No, I went to the Witchery, yeah.
And what do you think of them?
I always gained something from going to those.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember old talks about the electrolytes For some reason, there was always a it would be old Cook.
Yes, Alec Cook.
Yeah, Alec Cook. He would raise things about potassium. Am I right in remembering that he would say, "Well, I'd learned how to all about potassium, and now they've got this stuff. No, all about sodium. Now they've got this stuff, potassium. What's that all about?"
Lovely. Don, I'm probably going to finish. Anything else you want to say?
No.
We've done very well. Thank you very much indeed for that. Enjoyed it.
Yes.
Great. All the best. Now,
thank you for coming.